Amy Benjamin, I always love talking with you. But last week you rang me with something really intriguing. It was on the back of some health videos that we put up from somebody called Susie Turner. A lot of people appreciated the positive ideas, the health hacks, ways of looking after the body and mind and spirit. One of the things that Susie Turner said was that we must get away from judgment. We cannot descend into recrimination. And Amy, you rang me, and some of your words that really struck home with me were, the baddies know we yearn to honor the principle of non-judgment, and they will look to exploit that in us. So I want you to articulate your response to that line, that when we do win in this war of good and evil, many people term it that way, do we just gloss over and say, oh, well, we'll just forget it and heal and be spiritual and move on now? Or is there another path that we are called to follow? What's your view, Amy?
I think there's definitely another path we're called to follow. I mean, the whole idea of loving our and lighting our way in this dance we're doing with the cabal is ridiculous. I mean, we're here to bring to heal and to put an end to a really evil power structure. Why would we look at them, dominate them, and then say, ha ha ha, you know, no punishment for you, it's all okay, you've served a purpose, we appreciate you, we love you, now let's all go build a new earth. It doesn't work like that. And it need not work like that. And we can be very spiritual and not go down that path. My reading of our spiritual mission is to vindicate a very basic universal law, which is the law of one, or the oneness, which breaks down in kind of two parts. And the first part is the radical equality of all fractals of source vis-a-vis one another. So no fractal of source is better than another, and no fractal of source should dominate or seek to dominate another, much less do another harm. So that's what the cabal tries to do. They violate that tenet by trying to dominate most of the population of this planet, and we are all embodied souls, so that's wrong.
We'll go into that a bit more, Amy, later, but fractal of source, we should explain. I understand it to mean we all come from the one source and we are many, but we all have within us the, if you like, the flame of that purity, that potential is within each of us. Is that what you're meaning there, fractal of source?
A fractal is when the essence of something remains the same no matter the size, right? So if you think of Source God as a being of some kind, regardless of shape or nature, then to say we are fractals mean, at a very microscopic level, we look and are of the same nature as that being of Source. Yes, and if we're all fractals of the same kind, and there's no reason to think that they're not, then the idea of one fractal trying to dominate or hurt another is ridiculous. It's illogical. And that's what evil basically is. It's illogic. And when we find it on this plane, we shouldn't greet it with love and light. We should put it into submission so that it learns and it grows and evolves and stops engaging in such bad behavior. And that doesn't mean that we feel superior toward it. What it means is that the law that we're trying to vindicate, the law of one, is superior. And we're sources boots on the ground. And we had the luck of being born into this incarnation on the side of the light, not on the side of the dark. We've all been on the side of the dark. You and I have been on the side of the dark. And we know it well. We know it when we see it. And in this lifetime, we're called upon, because we've gone up the food chain, in part because of prior lives in the dark. We've gone up the food chain, and now we are here to vindicate that law. Does that mean we do it with an air of superiority? No. And I think that's what the old saying is, you know, judge not lest ye be judged. We judge in the sense of describing and incapacitating and, if necessary, punishing, but we don't judge in the sense of making a statement as to our own superiority. We've all been on the other side. So yes, we judge, but we judge with humility, and we judge with a sense of self-recognition, because we were all there. We were all on the dark. But we must judge. We must judge, because if we don't, who will? And if no one does, well, then there is no, can be no triumph of the light over the dark. The dark will perdure and will probably eventually beat back the light. And I can't believe anyone on the spiritual side wants that.
It's so interesting, though, because those on the spiritual side say, you know, there's a language like, if I don't forgive, then I'm only hurting myself. By forgiveness, I free myself from anger and from the desire for retribution. So therefore, I can be more at peace. What's the argument there, Amy, against that?
Well, of course we forgive. I mean, let's just take it down to the micro level. We might be able to see it more clearly. When it gets up to the political, societal level, sometimes things get muddy, but it needn't. Let's just take it down to the interpersonal level between human beings, right? Let's say you're in a bad marriage. Let's say it's an abusive marriage. You don't want to stay in the marriage. You want to get out of the marriage. And if the abuse is being is being meted out against you, you might have to get some intervention to put a stop to the abuse. That doesn't mean you don't forgive. You will go. You will reflect once you're separated. Once you've incapacitated your ex from hurting you, putting an end to the abuse. Great. That's step number one. Maybe getting the law in to police that might be necessary. But that doesn't mean you don't go on the forgiveness path at the same time. And there are lots of reasons to forgive. One is, as you mentioned, those feelings of anger and resentment eat away at the person who holds them. So they do harm to the person who holds them. On a very practical level, you'd want to forgive so as not to harm yourself. But there are also more sort of universal law-based reasons for forgiveness. The biggest one is the law of attraction and the mirroring effect. If there was an abuser in your life, something within you called that in. Because of the mirror effect, if you're healed and undistorted, you won't have an abuser show up in your life, or at least if they do, they won't gain traction, and they will enter a fairly abbreviated appearance in your life. They won't become your partner. They won't get anywhere near becoming your partner, because you're whole enough and complete enough to recognize someone who doesn't honor you. And if you do end up with an abusive partner, it's because some distortion in you called that in. And so you're going to first forgive yourself for the distortion, and then you're going to recognize probably that you had a soul contract with that person, or very likely did, and you forgive them. And in fact, you're grateful for them because they showed up, they carried out their contract, they meted out the pain you clearly needed to be able to work out, to get out that distortion within you. So yes, forgiveness, but that doesn't mean you stay in the abusive relationship. It doesn't mean you allow the abuse to continue. And in some cases, you know, punishment might be warranted. So now take that up to the political level. Collectively, we probably do have some karmic contracts with this cabal structure. Humanity has been severely distorted, and we have called in, and we can basically call that we are in the fall of mankind. That's what the fall of mankind represents. We fell. We can get into what that, you know, in more detail, what that meant, what that implicated, and how we can get out of it. But, you know, in a sense, the cabal structure is like the worst ex you can think of who was called in. And we've been mightily abused, and we've suffered at the hands of that cabal. But what now do we say as that bad spouse or partner is, you know, beating us? What do we say, honey? You know, your darkness, and I love the role you're playing in my life. You know, give it to me more now. You know, say keep doing it. No, we say you're not good. You are illogical. You are evil, and I will put an end to you. In a sense, I will move away from you, and the best thing I can do for you is to make you understand that. And so I will incapacitate you and prevent you from doing further harm. And to drive the point home so you really understand how distorted you've become, I will punish you, even to the point of taking your life and ending your incarnation, put you in the metempsychosis to give you a timeout so you can reflect. Because that's what you and I needed when we led dark lives. We needed to go into timeout. You don't evolve without being opposed, told to stand down, and exited, if you need to, from the incarnation, to then go and reflect, design a next incarnation where you hope to do better. That's the whole process. We've worked our way up so that, you know, we're on the side of light this time. And now the best thing we can do in the most loving of ways, that's a term of art, for the cabal minions and puppets and masterminds here is to describe their behavior, place it, judge it, and punish it. That's the most loving thing we can do for them. That was the favor done for all of us of the light who are ones of the dark. That's the only way that, at least in this epoch of fallenness, that you can evolve. Of course, if we weren't a fallen species, we could learn and evolve without pain and without punishment. But in the fallen state of mankind, unfortunately, it takes pain and oftentimes punishment. And in the case of, the lion's share of basic decent mankind fighting the cabal, it's going to take a hell of a lot of punishment to get this structure to understand where they went wrong. Yes, were we to blame at some level? We called it in, I'm sure. But we're on a healing path already, and we're beginning to see. And the more we see, the more we'll heal. And of course, we forgive at a certain level, and we always love. But love doesn't mean love and lighting. Love means tough love. Love means, and unfortunately, we don't have words other than love to denote what we're talking about. Other languages do. I think Greek has, 10 words for love. But we have just the one word love, so it's got to do a lot of work. But it doesn't mean love and lighting and treating the cabal like they're friends. They're not. They've really abused us. So we have to treat them firmly and appropriately and compassionately. But that might mean the death penalty, unfortunately, for many of them.
That's extraordinary. I've just come out of a meeting where one of the men in that meeting said, I would like to put the gallows up right now in front of the New Zealand Parliament to remind them all of what will come from the people. And Andrew Bridgen, who's one of the most respected members of the UK Parliament now, so many Kiwis write to me after I interview Andrew each time and go, I wish we had an Andrew Bridgen in New Zealand's Parliament. He's wonderful. But he put a call out last week or the week before for the death penalty for Bill Gates, which is really brave for a parliamentarian in the world scene. So this call is starting to come in.
Yes, because people understand how appropriate it is, and that it doesn't gainsay or contradict the idea of loving another embodied soul. It's consistent with that. Punishment is consistent with love at a certain level. Again, it doesn't have the fluffy bunny feeling of, please come to my party and I love you. No, no, no. But it's a respectful treatment and an appropriate treatment for an embodied soul that's committed certain acts. And in a sense, love can be equated to respectful and appropriate treatment. And that's what it is in this context. So getting back to Susie's comment, yes, we do judge. We must place the behavior like rating a school child. What grade are they in? Are they getting ready to graduate from Earth because they've learned, they've shown mastery? Are they more like primary kids acting in barbaric ways? We must describe their behavior. We must place them. And then we have to decide appropriately how to deal with them. And in that sense, we judge. We must judge. What else are we going to do? What? Ignore it? Celebrate it? I mean, you have to think of what the other options are. What options do we have other than incapacitation and punishment?
I guess the those on the inverted commas spiritual side will also use the argument, if they were willing to murder us with the poison from the jab, are we any better if we're willing to murder, to kill them?
Well, killing is it's an act that's morally neutral, and it depends on the context. Killing in self-defense is not murder. Killing for the purpose of putting a soul in time out in the metempsychosis so they can disembody and do the life between lives and do the reflection and then try again, I think that's a loving act. As a spiritual person, I don't regard death as a finality. I regard it as a transition of energy. And when you do it for the purpose of actually helping the evolution of a soul, I would consider that to be a loving act.
That's a fascinating line. And when we were talking earlier, you said, our mission is to confirm the rule of one, which does not allow for deceit or genocidal murder. Explain that, Amy, what that phrase meant from you.
Well, the love one, I mean, the way it's been taught to me is it's kind of comprised of two parts. One is the radical equality of all fractals of source. So, of course, if we're all radically equal, it doesn't make any sense for one fractal, say Satan, Lucifer, to say, I think I'm better than all of you and I will architect, design a structure that will result in all of your enslavement to me and your murder. That doesn't make any sense. It's illogical. And at its foundation, that's what evil is. It's illogical for Satan, Lucifer, and his minions to predate upon the rest when we're all radically equal and beloved fractals of source.
And when you say illogical, some would say sinful. You don't use the word sinful. Why is that?
No, I'm happy to use the word sinful, but I think illogical is a more comprehensive way of viewing it. It's insanity for someone like a being, an energy like Satan Lucifer, to put himself in a superior position, because and not just vis-a-vis the other source fractals, also vis-a-vis source, herself or himself or itself, how whatever pronoun you want. I conceive of her as a female energy, but that's how I've perceived her. So I call her. But Saint Lucifer, who's just a little fractal of source, talk about insanity and illogic, has posited that he is better than she is. Well, that's crazy. That's insane. Is sinful, the real meaning of sin is to miss the mark. And boy, is that missing the mark. You're completely misinterpreting the reality, the ontology, the cosmological ontology, the nature of being on a cosmic level, which is that there's source, and then there is a sea of little beloved fractals, and we're all equal. There's no indication in any cosmological ontology that carries any weight that some fractals are more important or beloved than others. There are pretensions to that, Satan, Lucifer, etc. But there's no evidence that any of the fractals are more important than the others. So sinful is fine as long as we understand what it means. It means missing the mark, failing to understand. On this level, this very low level, yes, we call it evil, because the pain that evil, that missing the mark engenders, is felt so acutely. And the illusion of separation and the seeming finality of death are all so scary that we come up with a word that is totally understandable. So yes, sinful is fine, but I understand that there's a deeper metaphysical reality behind it that for me more recommends words like illogical. Illogical and insane, madness.
Yeah, insane works for me as well. And so take us back from that to the rule of one. Explain that in more detail then. As we were talking about that.
We're here, in a sense, the great game is you incarnate, and there's a tremendous, at this level, tremendous illusion of separation, as if we have nothing to do with each other. We're all self-contained in our little physical vessels, and we really have nothing to do with each other. And in fact, we're all like identical twins. These equally beloved source fractals, we're all like identical twins. That doesn't mean we're not unique. We are. Each one is unique. Each soul has its, as I've been led to believe, has its own unique energy signature. And in a sense, the way a mother can tell her identical twins apart, source can tell each and every one of us apart, even though we must number in the, too numerous to count. So we are unique and yet identical. But when we incarnate, we seem so different. And in the fallen state of mankind, it's very difficult for us to maintain a consciousness based on a feeling of the oneness and the solidarity of the oneness. It's very hard to do that. In our unfallen state, before we fell, and I think this is what Yeshua ben Yosef, Jesus Christ, represented, mankind in its unfallen state. It's quite easy to bring the mindset of oneness down into this very dense entity, and he was able to hold it. That's why he had so many abilities. He had all of his DNA activated. He was a homo luminous. He was the angelic human, the original angelic human. In the fallen state, It's very difficult to do that, although individuals in the human community are trying to get back to that Christic state. It's a Christ. He was a Christ, not the Christ. Christic means you take that consciousness that is based on the knowledge and the sentiment of the oneness, and you're able to sustain it. That means when you incarnate down into this density and you look at another human being, in a sense, you do really, truly see yourself. Not that they're not unique. You're not the same, but you're very nearly the same. And then, of course, the moral imperative, do unto others as you would have done unto yourself, is so easy to follow because you really do. You have the consciousness where you're really able to look at another person and see them as basically a version of yourself. And of course, the moral imperative isn't really an imperative. You just do it as a matter of course. That's in our non-fallen state. That's in our original natural state. But we're fallen at the moment. But that's what we're currently trying to eclipse. And we're in the seasons of eclipse. What are we meant to be eclipsing in this eclipse season with the, I think it's the lunar eclipse tomorrow and, the big, much-ballyhooed April 8th solar eclipse in the United States. What exactly is being eclipsed? Well, I'll tell you what's being eclipsed. Nothing less than the fallen state of mankind. We are going back up after eons of being in a fallen state. And Yeshua ben Yosef, I believe, offered himself as an example so that we wouldn't forget, so that we wouldn't forget what we were. All that I am, you are too. All that I do, you will do too. And yes, he did say, let those, you know, who have not sinned cast the first stone. But what I think he was referring to was not the act of punishing, but the attitude accompanying punishment. Christ showed indignation in the temple when he turned over the tables of the money changers. He did not have a problem calling out bad behavior, but I don't think Christ ever would have said that he was a more beloved fractal or greater fractal of source than the souls embodied in the vessels of those money changers. It's the attitude with which you judge. You must do it with humility and self-recognition that you could be one of the people who deserve punishment. It's the attitude. And I think that's what that statement was getting at. We can learn a lot from the New Testament stories if we apply them in this context.
I would not have been able to get through the last months, particularly since I stood politically, Amy, without the example of Christ. Even the crawling to the cross, being spat at and kicked and called names and hurt, and yet this man, in his desperation on the cross, said, "My God, my God, you know, have you abandoned me? Have you gone?" And then that amazing line, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." That is perhaps where this idea of forgiveness at all costs somehow creeps in, you know, rather than there is a step before that, perhaps.
Go ahead.
Oh, just to finish that thought, we leave behind in the Old Testament the idea of an eye for an eye. He definitely makes that clear. We turn the other cheek. But I think it's confused humans. Where is that balance, you know, of turning the other cheek, not being a vengeful eye for an eye? We look at Israel and Palestine right now and the cruelty of Israel, you know, and Gandhi said it beautifully, an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. It doesn't work. But what you're talking about is a different level again. You're saying, no, this is actually going to help those people from the WHO, the UN, the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, Gates, right to our own Helen Clark, who rushed God out of New Zealand as much as she could, you know, right through to Jacinda Ardern, who clearly has no moral fiber or compass or real faith of human decency. These people need help to evolve in a way, you're saying.
Absolutely. And intention is everything. Mm-hmm. An eye for an eye is when you seek to hurt because you're in pain, you identify the person who meted out the pain, and now you want to hurt them. The motive of those of us who would punish the cabal and the puppets isn't one of meeting out pain out of that's rooted in our own anguish. It's it's meeting out punishment, which may involve termination of their incarnation, because it's the only appropriate reaction to their distortion. There is no other appropriate reaction to their distortion. You can't simply say, I forgive you. Let's go back to, you know, the way it was before. Yes, come back into our communities. Yep, forgiven. All's fine. Yes, thank you for serving a dark role. We appreciate it. Yep, everything's good. You want to do some more darkness? Yeah, go ahead. That would be very inappropriate, a very inappropriate reaction. And when we mete out punishment, we don't do it from a place of distortion. We do it with a dedication to simply vindicating that precious universal law of one. That's what's superior. We don't do it with a sense of superiority ourselves, but we do it with a sense of the superiority of sources of the prime cosmological metaphysical law, that we want to see everyone adhere to. And the metaphor that I really like, Liz, is that of the school. And, you know, I'm not the first one to say Earth is like a school for souls. But let's say we're in year 13, right? And we're in command of our faculties. We're in command of our emotions. We're in command of our behavior. We are well behaved. We act honorably. We've learned how to do that over the years. And then let's say we come into contact with a bunch of middle schoolers who are acting terribly, and they're terrorizing the teachers and making a mess of the classroom, and no one can learn, and they're just causing distress in the school. Now, if year 13s, how would we regard such year 7s and year 8s? Well, we'd say, well, these guys, we would want to get them under control and teach them and help them grow up out of, in a sense, love, out of a sense of respect, that it would be appropriate for us to try to get these year 7s and year 8s under control. And if that means putting them in detention, kicking them out of the school for a while, that might be appropriate. But it doesn't come from a place of vengeance. It doesn't come a place of anger and distress. It comes from a place of what would be the appropriate way to deal with these distorted members of our community. And that's how I regard the cabal. I am a year 13. I like to think I am, and they are, I think, year 4s. Or maybe your 3s, and they're making a real mess of it, and they're making a real mess of the planet. And I'll do my best to bring them under control and teach them. And again, that might mean exiting them from their current incarnation. They'll be back. I have no doubt that they'll be back. And hopefully they'll have studied up a little bit on what it means to be, a good member of our reality.
I love that. Just getting back to that line you said, to confirm the rule of one, that's our mission. And the rule of one does not allow for deceit and genocidal murder. And they're like three-year-olds who want to be shown the right way. It does help to clarify. And I think as the time draws near, and it is drawing near, where people now are really deeply questioning what is going on, their lies and the oppressions of the people. I heard today, Amy, that barely any New Zealand farmers are able to get loans from banks. The bank has shut us down, has shut Loyal down. It is just terrible what is going on in terms of the silencing and the censorship of New Zealanders, just looking here alone. So as the time draws near for judgment, it behoves every Kiwi to think, what would I do with this lot who, some say, have gone on a Nuremberg list, and on that list in New Zealand are apparently many names of doctors. There are names of some judges. There are certainly many names of politicians on the Nuremberg list here. There are even names of some food providers who are being oppressive.
And I'm glad you raised Nuremberg. You know, those who say let's love and light going forward. You know, what do they say about Nuremberg? Should we not have done Nuremberg? Was that an inappropriate reaction to encountering the remains of the Nazi structure at the end of World War II? Was that inappropriate? I don't think it was inappropriate. I think it was very appropriate, and it gave German society the best chance at a fresh start that we could. And, you know, I'm glossing over a lot of history here, but, you know, West Germany did pretty damn well in those first 40 years. It was able to recover as a society, in part because of the statements of justice and temperance that were made at Nuremberg. That's love. What happened at Nuremberg was a loving act. It may not have felt like love in the sense that many English speakers think of that word, but it was a loving act what was done. We made statements and adjudicated and vindicated certain laws of humanity that the species as a whole desperately needed in order to go forward on a stable and humane basis. And the people who were jailed or killed pursuant to the judgments at Nuremberg, there was Albert Speer, who rehabilitated while in prison. And those who were killed, I'm sure they're probably back here now trying to do better. It's all good. It's all good. But the one thing that's indispensable is to vindicate the law of one. That's why we're here. We vindicate it with humility and with compassion, but we vindicate it. Or else, why are we even here?
There's an argument to say not enough perhaps were killed after World War II because many went to America. And there are people I've talked to who argue strongly that we are in the Third Reich, that it was a Nazi-driven, cabal-laid plan that has got us to this really sorry state, this covert war. What do you say to that, Amy?
I think the Nazis, the Nazi structure and their Western backers, because they had backers in the United States and Britain too, they sort of faked losing. And I think a lot of that Nazi power structure was simply relocated after the war by American financiers and the intelligence services and in Britain as well. So yes, I think the Nazis only appeared to lose World War II. In fact, they set up operations elsewhere. But, you know, the cabal is very good at doing that. I'll give you another example close to the history of my country. We won the Revolutionary War. We thought we did send the British packing, and we thought for good, but they crept back in. They crept back in via the financial system. And by the Civil War, and just after the Civil War, they got control of the United States surreptitiously and covertly. And, you know, by the time the Federal Reserve was established in 1913, and then they Machiavelli'd the United States into World War I, you know, the writing was on the wall. The United States was no longer independent. So, you know, the cabal is very good at saying, okay, we lost, and then sort of snatching a victory out of the defeat, sort of covertly. And of course, we'll have to be very careful this time around about ensuring that we get every last one, every last puppet, every last person who knowingly and intentionally served the cabal agenda in the hoax-demic and the Vax genocide. We have to get every last one, and we have to have patience. Nuremberg was terminated. It was too superficial, and it was terminated too soon. But the idea of justice that was behind it, and therefore the idea of punishment, judgment, and punishment behind Nuremberg was absolutely appropriate. I don't think it was taken far enough. So I can't understand a mindset that says that justice and punishment are inappropriate at this time. Embodied souls miss the mark. They sin. They go crazy. And the appropriate response is to call them out, to stop them, and to punish them so that they don't do it again.
Getting back,
it's the only
to
appropriate response.
Getting back to your idea of we are all part of this fractal oneness, we are all fractals of the oneness, what does happen to those who still have the same light that you and I have? Do they simply ignore that light part of them? They go and play in the darkest corner of the darkest garden that they can find. They say, I'm turning my back on the light for this lifetime. What is it in your mind?
I think it is a bit of a game. I think our natural state, not as an incarnated soul, but as a disembodied soul, is probably one of pure bliss. I mean, think of, you know, just a grotto of fractals. They get everything. They're royal sons and daughters of Source, spoiled rotten. They get everything they want immediately, all the time. Source created an experiential matrix hologram for experience, for stories. That's how I see it, and that's what my own sort of metaphysical investigations have shown to me. It seems so awful to say that someone would say that a soul would resolve to be on the side of darkness for an incarnation or a span of incarnations. It seems so awful to say it when we look at it from this level. But I think at the level of outside the time and space, this experiential matrix, which I think souls come into for these incarnations, outside that, in the void, zero point, with Source, it's just kind of for fun to see what life is like on the other side. There's redemption always. There's redemption always, as long as you ask for it, as long as a soul asks for it. Trouble with Satan Lucifer is that thus far, he or she or whatever, they haven't asked for it. They haven't come in from the cold. As long as they don't, there can be no redemption. But if a soul wants redemption, it's like the prodigal son story in the Bible. They get it. They get it. They submit. They say, I know what I did wrong. I will try my best not to do it again. And then the final question is, well, do you forgive yourself? And that's the hardest one. Because in order for a soul to forgive themselves, they have to know two things. They have to know what they are, which is a fractal of her, and they have to know what they are not, which is they're not her. They're just a mini her. They're not her. That's where Satan makes the mistake. He thinks he's as good as she is. So the road to asking for redemption can be a bit tricky for a soul. They make it. They get it. That's my understanding. So to your question, Liz, why would anyone resolve to have a dark incarnation? Which I'm sure I have done probably many times. And I like to think I was very competent as a dark actor. and I feel I know them based on my own soul level experience. For experience, boy, do I appreciate the light now. And why do I appreciate the light now? Why? I can only think of one reason. And that's because I partook of the dark. Boy, did I partake of the dark. I know it. And I know I don't want it. But how do you know you don't want it unless you've been in it and you've seen the results of it? If you zoom out and take a really cosmic perspective, I think we can readily see why souls line up to have dark incarnations. They know that they'll learn all the more about the light if they do. It's a hard pill for us to swallow because we're so far down. The illusion of separation is so great, and we're so divorced from any sense of our true cosmological nature. We don't have an agreed upon ontology at a cosmic level, a nature of being. We don't have that. We don't. We should. We don't. We once did. We no longer do. If we did, and I think we will, then we'll really achieve a big jump in our evolution. But right now, we don't. These are all really important questions that every member of the so-called political class in New Zealand should be beginning to talk about. True nature of reality on a cosmological level, the cosmic ontology, the metaphysical laws. Everyone who claims to be an intellectual in New Zealand should be talking about this, because this is the reality that's been ignored. And it's really great of you, prompted by, you know, your conversations with your colleagues and friends, to begin introducing these subjects, because they're very, very important, not only for the question of judicial punishment in New Zealand as a result of the latest crimes against humanity, but also just to, enable humans to go forward in full recognition of what they are and how they were created. We've lost a lot of knowledge and we have to begin to get it back. And we're not going to get it back unless we start talking about it without feeling embarrassed about doing so.
Beautifully put. Judicial punishment and judicious punishment, punishment that suits what they have done. You know, two brushes with death I've had, Amy. I know that on that experience where I felt very strongly that I was going to leave this planet and I was floating away, I recognized very clearly that the relief that I had done the best I could do with everything I had in my life, and that I wasn't perfect, but that I had done it with the best part of my heart to contribute something good, that really matters at the point of death. That was the first brush I had with death. But another was just apropos of what you've described, with somebody I loved very much when I was little and who struggled very much with alcohol and therefore was highly abusive. And it was a deep struggle between us. And when they died, within a few minutes, I happened to have someone in the room with me who didn't know my history with this person, who said, "Oh, look, I don't know if this freaks you out, but there's somebody here." Now, I wasn't sure what I believed about that, and I was a bit staggered, you know, that I would never have had this reconciliation with this soul that I'd so wanted at the end of their life. And she said the most interesting thing. She said, "I don't know if it's this person you just described to me, Liz, but this is what they're saying to me. Please tell her, I am so sorry. The energy down there was too dense. I couldn't break through it." And in that moment, two things happened. Absolute forgiveness from me of that soul. But the second thing was a realization that potentially the flow to death is as thin as a sort of silk gossamer thin curtain just floating in the wind. And when we go through that curtain from life to death, if we choose it, we can drop away all that illogic, that sin, that hurt, that damage we've done. We can see what we've done immediately. That staggered me, Amy. That staggered me, that potential that it could happen so quickly. Now my feeling is the soul then goes on and has to do a lot of work looking at how they wasted a good life, hurting others, that is part of the learning. But the fact that it could drop away so immediately, just even if that story were potentially true, it's such food for thought for people that immediately we see whether we've lived a good life or a very dark life, an evil life.
Yes, and, you know, that's why punishment, even capital punishment, is when it's appropriate, because the perpetrator has committed heinous acts, is capital punishment is a loving gesture. You would walk someone to the firing squad and say, look, I know people, Liz. I know people on the dark side, friends and family. I'll just leave it at that. Mm. And if necessary, I would fully acquiesce in their being punished to the fullest extent of the law. And I would have no problem walking them to, or I wouldn't say I would have no problem, but I would, with calmness, walk them to the firing squad, and I would hug them, and I would give them a kiss, and I would say, "This is for your best." And that would be a loving act. Would seem unnatural on our current understanding of what death is, which is a very materialistic understanding. We think death is a finality. I think that's a misunderstanding. And I think your story makes that clear. When we operate from such a materialistic view of death, of course, walking a loved one to the firing squad would seem outrageous. But when you zoom out and you develop a more metaphysical understanding of death, then it can appropriately be described as a loving act. But we do have to reorient our thinking. We have to become far less materialistic in our thinking. And we have to open our minds up to the very real possibility that the materium is just the very bottom part of existence, and that there's a whole world above it that is not perceived by our five limited senses. Then we can understand these issues with much greater wisdom, with much greater wisdom. And I think there will be consensus eventually.
You and I both come from legal training, from legal backgrounds. So all of this conversation is predicated on having the evidence beyond any reasonable doubt that these people who would face this sort of punishment are guilty of it. We're not talking a kind of tale of two cities, Dickens' version of the French Revolution, where there was just a bloodbath and people were going mad with wanting revenge on all and sundry. And that is a danger, Amy, because when enough people wake up to the fact that we've had a government willing to murder us, willing to maim us, willing to throw us aside as if we have no value whatsoever as these beautiful, precious human lives, there could be a real cry for a real bloodlust unless that is managed.
Well, that's why, I mean, I don't want to be flippant about this, but that's why I don't lose too much sleep over what I think is the maladvice of your acquaintance saying, let's just love and light the cabal and look forward and not look back. The reason I don't lose too much sleep over it is that I think the unthinking masses, once they wake up, will go crazy with rage, and the idea of love and light will not be accepted. It will not only be voted down; it will be trampled upon. There will be an urge to non-judicial violence, of course, by people who are not versed in the law, don't understand or value the virtues of legal process. There will be an impetus to mob action and to mob violence, so much so that the Christopher Hitchens and the Jacinda Arderns will be showing up at your door begging you to take them in and save you from the mob, because you do understand the value of judicial process. There will be no love and light. Trust me. The masses of fairly ignorant people will not go down that role. There will be judicial process if people like you can continue to have an influence. I think the two choices are judicial process through representatives of New Zealand society like you, and mob violence on the other hand. And we want to avoid mob action. We just do, because that doesn't recommend humanity very much. We've got to, with as much calm and peace as possible, stop the carousel, stop the music, get everyone off, identify who's who did what, and then calmly, but with resolution and a deep respect for the universal laws and a deep persistence to vindicate those laws, we must then bring order to the situation by finding guilt and then meting out punishment. And that's the only alternative to mob violence. Love and light. Love and lighting is not going to happen. But if we don't get out in front of this and start bringing judicial process to it, mob violence might prevail. We don't want that. That would bring humanity down.
It's really honest. And the final question really is the big one. I heard the other day Helen Clark's nursing her either mother or father, who's about 102. And I thought, Helen Clark must be thinking about her own mortality now. This woman who's lusted so long after power and position in the world, none of which means anything. Sic transit gloriae mundi, my father used to say, the glory of the world always passes away. But somebody like that who really worked hard to get God out of New Zealand society, how do we turn that back so that there is some moral fiber again in this country, some morality, some moral code? Because I hear so much, thanks to that woman, there's been an unleashing of amoral characters. I hear so much about corruptions in New Zealand. People ripping each other off because they can get away with it, and they have no sense of a divine source or being answerable at the end of their lives to that divine source that created them. Helen Clark has really robbed New Zealand of something, taking God out of this country, I believe, or the divine, or whatever you call it love, call it nature, call it God, what call it him, her, them, it. It doesn't matter the name, that there is something beyond this mere physicality and this human life. How do we ever reintroduce a sense of being accountable, of needing to be moral, Amy, of God?
Well, we start talking about it and not being intimidated away from talking about it. We push back against this radical materialism of the left of mainstream society, and there's much that can be pointed to anecdotally across many facets of human society. And people are starting to talk. They're starting to talk about what they encounter in meditation, how they open up channels to their higher selves, to the part of their soul that is not embodied. And we can do a show about that, how you do that. People are talking about the power of collective meditation and why the heart resonance between people amplifies their ability to connect beyond the materium. And another thing that will enable the conversation about God and the reintroduction of God into the conversation is, believe it or not, modern science, which is drawing closer and closer to a spiritual truth. Science goes down to the micro level. It's finding more and more signs of an intelligent design and a mathematics. I mean, just think of the Fibonacci sequence and its prevalence throughout everything, its omnipresence in the world. But it's beyond the Fibonacci. It's the clear increasing evidence of intelligent design in every facet of our natural world. And then, of course, when you get into all the quantum technologies and the quantum this and the quantum that and the observer principle, science is beginning to look very spiritual all of a sudden, and more scientists will be pulled in that direction. And it will go from 3D physics to metaphysics. Metaphysics is a more sophisticated version of physics, and the physicists will get there. So sooner or later, the stupid idiots over at stuff are going to have to start reporting this, and then the stupid intelligentsia here might begin to ask some questions, might even sign up for a yoga class, might do the things that begin to open up their crown chakra and their third eye, might begin to be open to the possibility of a conversation with energies they cannot see with their two eyes. So it'll happen, but it's going to be a process, and it's going to take time. I do think that a lot of people are going to be coming into a very painful time in their lives, both medically and financially. And of course, pain is wonderful for opening people up. It opened me up, all the personal pain I experienced in my life. That's what cracked me open. I was very much a left brain New York lawyer. I was born and initially raised a Catholic, but I fell away from that by the time I was in late high school. And I didn't look back until I had enough trauma in my personal life where, you reach that road and society has its boot at your neck, and you've got two choices. You're either going to lie down and die, or you're going to insist on your life and find answers. And that sent me finding answers, and pain is necessary. And I think the mass population here and throughout the Western world is going to be feeling a lot of pain, and that'll crack so many of them open because the energies are right. We've got eclipses. We've got a great deal of beneficial heart-opening energies coming in to assist us at this time, to crack us open and begin to help us see and understand. They're called ascension energies, and I think they'll work in New Zealand. And so this is a process. It took a long time for the cabal to get God out of society, and it'll be a process to get God back in. But we will recover that aspect of ourselves. We will. It's inevitable.
I would love to do a follow-up interview with you on that. And Amy Benjamin, I really don't have words except this. It's just a delight to talk to you. You're beautiful. thoughtful openness and intelligence. I think many Kiwis will find much richness in it. Thank you, Amy.
You are so welcome. Anytime. I hope people are open to it. I hope it elicits. There will be people who will say, ah, she's wrong on this. Ah, she's wrong on that. Ah, she said. But I hope people will greet it with an open mind and will, rather than tear it down, tear statements down, I hope they'll simply say, well, maybe it didn't resonate with all of it, but I took note at what she said there, and I'll take that point over there, and I'll put it in my arsenal. And I hope people will view it with that kind of open mind. And you know, we can only do what we can do. We can only drop the seeds. But the first thing to do is what we did, which is to talk about it without apology. And that's very important, and to set the tone for that so that more and more people can talk about it. That's how they've kept God out. They've shamed anyone who wants to talk about it. But it's essential that we talk about it, because there's no way back, I don't think. There's no way to heal without bringing God into the equation. I could not find a way. I had to bring God into the equation because I was at a fork in the road. I was at a fork. I had two spectacularly failed marriages. And I mean spectacularly, not just fail. And, you know, I reached the age of 55 and I was out of a job, career ended, fairly indigent. And by all 3D measures, was a complete failure. Had practically zero friends, black sheep of the family, everything. And I was at the fork in the road. And I spent the last 4 years finding my way back. Took four years. 2020, yeah, 3.5 years. 3.5 years. A dark night of the soul. And it just finished up because I reached a point where I said, I think I'm healed now. And there was agreement. It took 3.5 years. So I understand the necessity of pain. And I think there will be pain. And some won't make it. And that's okay. I made it because, you know, there were probably prior lives where I didn't make it, where I came to the same bloody fork in the road and I lay down and died. Mm-hmm. And then you tee up another one and you say, all right, I'm going in. I've got this karma. I'm going to need this and this and this pain in order to get me to that fork in the road. Because until you get to the fork in the road, you're not going to have that choice point. You've got, and these are kind of, I call them graduation lives. When you've evolved enough, where you're like, okay, I think I'm close enough that I can actually get across the line if the incarnation is architected in just the right way and I've had just enough karmics at just the right time cross my path. And that's why I think we've got these contracts. I think I can push through. I think I can get through. And this has been a graduation life for me. And I think I've had other ones, but I made it this time, finally. And I'm sure you've already made it or you are making it. It's a graduation life for you. And it's a great feeling when you know that you've wrapped it up. You've wrapped it up for your incarnational line. You've done it for all of them, for all of the characters you've played. You've wrapped it up. It's like with the baton, you know, a relay team and the passing of the baton. The life that gets it over the line for the team is a joyous life. And all of your teammates, all the people you played are right there with you, cheering you on as you bring it over the line for your gang. It's a great feeling. Yes. And everyone has to do that. And no one can do it for them. And that's why, ultimately, we don't lose sleep over all the normie sheeple muggles. They'll get there. But it's going to take time. And it might take 10 more lifetimes for them to do. It's okay. You zoom out. You see the process. And it's okay. It's really okay. And remember that back in the void, outside the time and space experiential matrix, We're all dancing around in absolute orgasmic bliss, all of them. That's what orgasm means, the bliss that's so intense that it feels. I mean, a human 3D orgasm is the greatest approximation. That joy you feel is the, and that's why sex is transcendental, and the orgasm is the feeling of being at the Godhead, because that joy you feel in that moment of climax is how you always feel back at, I call it the grotto, with source, outside of time and space, in the void. That's how you feel all the time. Can you imagine feeling that, but even more intense, all the time? That's your natural state of being, because the joy is so intense, and your fellowship and love of all your fellow fractals is so intense. And when we say we want to wake up with joy and bliss, if we could bring just a percentage of that feeling of what it's like to be back in that state, in here, where we seem so separate, but we're not. Just every day, if you could bring just a little bit of that, and you wake up and you bounce out of bed. I remember what it's like back there. I remember. I'm a royal child, and so are all of they, but they don't really know it. But I know it, and I'll remember that when I deal with them. That even Jacinda Ardern, sometimes I want to say to her in my mind, take off that silly costume. Take off the costume of a monster. I know what you are. You're a royal child of her. What are you doing, you idiot? But she's got the costume of a monster on. And so we'll have to play it out. We will play it out. But back in the grotto, we're best mates. She's an identical twin. And we have to keep all of this in our mind almost simultaneously as we honor the illusion, but we know the truth. We honor the illusion. She's a monster. She's separate from me. I must punish her. And yet we know the truth. And one of the reasons it's taken me 3.5 years to get through this dark night of the soul, because I had a tremendous capacity, Liz, for anger, righteous anger, tremendous. It was destroying me, both on a personal level vis-a-vis my ex-spouses and on a professional political level. It all happened at once. I was consumed by anger, and it was incinerating me. When you can know the truth and let it infuse the illusion every day, that's a good feeling, because then you're stable. Inside, every day. And that's what we aim for. That's what we aim for. That peace. That peace. And it's hard, because it requires constant focus. Constant focus. And that's why I've had to be a hermit for 4 years. I had to focus so hard. First, I had to tease out the nature of reality, understand what I was looking at on this plane and outside of this plane. And then I had to begin to, even though I understood it at an intellectual level, and the reason I did is that more and more my soul was able to come in. Because as I kind of was able to slough off all the huge slabs of negative emotion, more of my soul was able to come in, and it just braided. My higher soul just, it was like, it's like a braided walk-in where you get that fusion of the higher soul and then the smaller egoic personality, which was Amy, and more came in. And so this was giving me the knowledge I needed to then release more. And then more came in. It was a beautiful upward spiral of ascension. But knowing it intellectually, understanding is one thing, but feeling it each and every day and keeping that focus, that required a couple of years of walking 4 hours a day to get. And so it's a process, and not everyone will make it this time. And like I said, it's okay. It's everyone is on their unique journey, and it really is true. You have an incredibly unique journey. So have I. So is everybody. And it's okay. So we achieve our peace that way. And we contribute what we can. But getting to the Anzac thing, we don't run ourselves into the ground, because if we love Source, we must take care of ourselves. You are a mini Source. I am a mini Source. If we love her, we've got to take care and honor ourselves. Have to.
I'd love to talk to you about that Anzac one in the third piece, if you're willing to do that. You know, something really interesting, Amy, when I was that teenage girl in angst and I was on the outside, the star and the head girl and all the other things, inside dying, absolutely dying. And so often I wanted to take my own life. And somebody told me, and I think it saved my life, if you take your own life, that point at which you leave, you must redo the same things, the same sorts of people, the same challenges back to the point where you are about to take your own life and you decide not to take your own life. It's extraordinary. And that kept me here because I thought, I don't want to come and incarnate with these same sorts of people again. And it kept me here. But isn't that extraordinary that just that one line stopped me from wanting to leave and take the so-called easy path out? And I'm so thankful for that graduation life that we've both had is such a gift. But my God, it takes guts. It takes guts.
It's and again, I think there are a lot of failed graduations, like, you know, taking the final exam. Oh, I failed it three times. Here I go again. You know, you sit down with your incarnational advisor who's architected it. And you sit, I'm sure you sit down. Have you ever read Journey of Souls by, what's his name? Michael Newton.
It's wonderful. Classic. My son read it and loved it and has told me about it. Yeah. I need to read it. Yeah, it's
just wonderful. You sit down with an incarnational advisor. Basically, I want to be an incarnational advisor because I think that would be the best life. But you're like, you know, you could do a skit on this. You know, I've dabbled in playwriting, so I so want to write this up. You know, you do a skit and like, do you really think, do I have enough karmics lined up here? Because, you know, I'm going to need one at here and here. And do we have the right person? Like, you know, I want to get that person who was really good student in my class. They will hew to the contract. They will. And then, of course, we've got our dharmics lined up too, the people who come just the right time to help us out. Mm-hmm. We've got our dharmic contracts too. I've had some amazing dharmic people show up in my life just when I needed it.
There's a beautiful book by Neil Donald Walsh. It's a children's book. It's called The Little Soul and the Sun. Have you ever seen that one? Oh, look it up. It's absolutely gorgeous. And it's a little soul going to God. I'll line up. I'll go down there. And what lesson do you want to learn, says God? I want to learn forgiveness. So God says to the other souls, well, one step forward and go down with this soul so that they can learn forgiveness. And his best little friend up there steps forward and he's so thankful. And then she hangs her head when the two of them are alone and says, yes, but to do this, you know, I have to actually forget who I really am. And in order for me to make it back, I need you to always remember who I really am so that in giving you this help, I can come back. It's so beautiful. So beautiful.
There are so many beautiful things. One thing that I was shown is just knowledge that came in either from my higher self or my guides was they took me basically outside of the experience. I mean, there's the experiential, as I've been guided to understand, there's the source created experiential matrix. But of course the Kabbalah has inverted that, you know, so what the Matrix movie calls the Matrix is the inverted Kabbal embedded malign matrix within the beautiful experiential matrix that Source created. But I was taken outside of that to the moment of the birth of my soul. When we literally just come out of Source, and it was a ceremony, and I imagine that every soul goes through it, and it was something like this, and I got this in a very deep meditation. The Source is a female energy. It's female because it's generative, and the males don't generate, the female does. And out of the, and so the babies, the fractals, are female. But then the male, unlike the biblical version, which I think is an inversion where they took the rib out of Adam and created Eve, I think that's probably a Kabbal inversion. I think what happens is that they take the male energy comes out of the female that's born of source, and that's the protective male side of you. That's your inner masculine. That's your sacred masculine. And then you've got your divine feminine, which is the original fractal. The sacred masculine comes out. And so there's the sacred masculine energy of you standing astride the divine feminine. And then there is a marriage of sorts, and that is the sacred marriage or the inner union. And it goes something like this, and source kind of officiates the taking of the vows. The sacred masculine says to the divine feminine, this is what was shown to me. The sacred, and source is standing sort of source, you know, as the feeling of source is behind the sacred masculine. As the sacred masculine looks at the divine feminine, and the sacred masculine says, when things go right, I shall adore you. And then there's a pause. And source is whispering into the sacred masculine's ear. And then the sacred masculine says, and when things go wrong, when they go very, very wrong, there's a pause. Source whispers, I shall adore you even more. Even more. Now imagine, imagine having that. And then imagining that every soul goes through that ceremony. Source knows we're going to fuck up. She knows that we're just little versions of her, and that when she kind of throws us into this matrix and says, have fun and come back and tell your stories, we're going to distort because we're just mischievous little mini versions of her. Of course we're going to distort, and she knows that. And so that's the vow. When things go right, I shall adore you. And when they go wrong, as they inevitably will, I shall adore you even. Now, when you think of that, it does make it easier to forgive. Because we're made to fuck up. And that's why redemption is not a problem. We're like mischievous puppies. We're going to be mischievous when we go into that matrix. And when we come out, we're asked three questions. Do you know what you did wrong? Will you try to do better? And do you forgive yourself? Yes, I forgive myself. Why? Why do I forgive myself? Because I know that all that you are, I am. And what else? That I'm not you. I'm just a little you. Okay, go play. Go play. That's it. That's redemption. And it's handed out. But you have to answer those questions. And then you go back. That's what was shown to me is the true nature of reality. It makes it quite easy to forgive. If you posit that as our true state of nature. And this is the dream, Liz. This is the dream. That is reality. This is the dream. And we're all wearing costumes. Some are wearing monster costumes. You and I are wearing human angelic costumes. But we once wore monster costumes. And when we go out, we shed our costumes and we run back. We sit in that hall waiting to go in and answer those three questions. And if we can't answer them appropriately, source says, go sit out there some more and reflect a little bit more. And then we go and play. That's what's been shown to me. And it's made all the difference.
Exquisite, Amy. It's just exquisite.